Okay, so Dan asked me to give a sort of broad introduction to chemistry, which is rather a lot. So about the first 60% of this talk is going to be a broad but necessarily sort of shallow introduction to metabolism and enzymes and evolution, and it's going to cover a lot of ground. Please feel free to interrupt if I use jargon terms that you don't understand or if you just need clarification. And before I start, I should just say thank you for inviting me. This is my third workshop here, and I have learned a tremendous amount at every one, so they're really a treat. Okay, so first I want to convince you that metabolism is actually interesting. Maybe you don't need convincing, but this is a slide I use for my undergraduates. So one of the reasons that we're interested in metabolism is that it gives us insight into the various lifestyles of life on Earth. So we have organisms that live in all kinds of challenging environments, including the anoxic environment in the human gut, acid mine drainage streams that have a pH of maybe 1. There are microbes that live inside rocks. There are microbes that live in hydrothermal pools in Yellowstone that have high levels of toxic metals. There are sap-feeding insects that basically take in only sugar and have to make amino acids, but themselves lack the ability to do that, so they have to have symbiotic bacteria do it for them. These are tube worms that grow at hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean. And that's a very nutrient-poor environment. They have symbiotic bacteria that will fix carbon for them. And I thought I should at least throw in a tree and an animal to round this out. My warthogs are my favorite weird animals. Another reason that metabolism is interesting is that we can use this kind of knowledge to give us potential drug targets for treating infectious diseases. So if we can understand what kinds of enzymes various pathogens must use to survive, then we can design drugs to target those enzymes and potentially kill the bacteria. And a third reason is that, of course, if we can understand something, then we can manipulate it. And so there is a huge amount of interest in what's called white chemistry. It used to be called green chemistry, but it's now called white chemistry for reasons that I don't understand. But the idea is that you can engineer bacteria to take in some kind of simple carbon source, and then you can use those bacteria to synthesize things like biofuels, pharmaceuticals, commodity chemicals, biodegradable polymers. So these are all good things that we can do if we understand something about metabolism. So this is metabolism in a nutshell. The idea is that organisms have to capture energy from the environment. They can do that in two ways, from redox reactions and from light. And then the idea is to capture that energy and the electrons coming from oxidation reactions and use those materials for biosynthesis. So that's the overview of metabolism. So I'm not going to talk about capturing energy from light because I don't have that much time, but I do want to talk a little bit about redox reactions, because this is one of the dominant ways that living organisms capture energy from the environment. So just to define a few terms, you may know these. I hope I'm not insulting anybody's intelligence by defining these. The term oxidation refers to loss of electrons, and reduction is gain of electrons. Okay, and the oxidant is the species that's going to get the electrons, and the reductant is the species that's going to give up the electrons. Okay, and there are a couple of little mnemonics that students like to use. Leo the lion says, "Grr, loss of electrons is oxidation. Gain of electrons is reduction," or oil rig. Oxidation is loss. Reduction is gain.
Yeah, okay. That's the one I use.
So whichever works for you. Okay, so oxidation reactions release energy. So this is the explosion of the Hindenburg, which was an oxidation reaction between hydrogen and oxygen. Took a spark, and there you go. Flames are also oxidation reactions. So carbon materials reacting with oxygen to form CO2, water, and releasing energy. This is the kind of oxidation reaction that you may be most familiar with in terms of how animals get energy from the environment, and that is that they oxidize things like carbohydrates or amino acids, producing CO2, water, and energy. And so this is what we do.
So I'm embarrassed to say that after all this time, I still just can't directly connect to electrons. Like, that just doesn't feel very intuitive. Of course, I know that chemistry is about electrons and all that stuff, but I look at that, I don't say to myself, oh, obviously this thing is gaining electrons, this one is losing. Like, that part is still obscure.
Okay. I could go to the blackboard and show you my personal, I have a personal scheme for how you figure out what the oxidation state of every atom in a molecule is, and then you can look at it before and after the reaction, and you can say, oh, this atom got more oxidized or less oxidized. Okay, so I can do that. Okay, well, so one of the things I want to tell you about metabolism and redox reactions is that this is the way we do it, but there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, and this applies to metabolism. Okay, so it turns out that many different compounds can serve as electron donors in redox reactions. So it's not just carbon compounds, not just carbohydrates. So here's an example. Sulfolobus acetylcalderius was isolated from one of these mud pots in Yellowstone, and it uses oxygen as an electron acceptor. So O2 is the oxidant, which sounds fine, right? The electron donor is actually hydrogen sulfide. But this redox pair allows Sulfolobus to capture energy from its environment. Here's another example. Iron oxidizing bacteria that are responsible for this red color and this acid mine drainage stream. The red color is actually coming from ferric oxide that is produced by these bacteria in a redox reaction where they're taking electrons from iron 2 and they're donating them to oxygen to form iron 3. Okay, just like many different things can serve as reductants, many different things can serve as oxidants too. Okay, so it's not only oxygen that can act as an oxidant. So all of these kinds of inorganic compounds can actually receive electrons in living organisms, and they are oxidants. So here's an example. Thiobacillus denitrificans oxidizes sulfur, so its electron donor is hydrogen sulfide, but its electron acceptor, or its oxidant, is actually nitrate. Here's another example, methanogens that are found in the guts of humans and of cows. They use hydrogen gas as an electron donor, and they actually use CO2 as an electron acceptor. So the oxidant is CO2.
Okay, so this is a super naive question, but like, for the most part, is it that you have kind of like core kind of biochemical pathways, and then just like the stuff on the outside is the thing which is changing, or is it just like the whole thing is changing, or both?
Okay, you mean just with respect to redox reactions?
Yeah, for example.
So a lot of the biochemical, and I'll show you a little bit of the biochemical machinery in a minute, A lot of the biochemical machinery is pretty well conserved, except for the thing at the end, which donates electrons to one of these oxidants. But the core proteins that are involved in the redox processes are pretty well conserved. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a picture of that, but I'll mention it again when I get there.
On the basic question, so your intro slide, you told us that these different schemes speak to different lifestyles and different organisms.
Okay.
I get it that based on local availability, they are forced to different things. Mm-hmm. But is there a way of looking at these reactions and also the way the swans living an affluent lifestyle and the swans more aseptic?
Oxygen is the best oxidant. Nitrate is not quite as good. So generally organisms, if they have a choice between oxygen and nitrate, will use oxygen first. If there's no oxygen, then they'll turn to nitrate. And you can sort of go down the line from the best oxidants to the worst oxidants, and organisms will basically, you know, choose the best one that they can get because they'll get the most energy out of it.
And that's the ordered list?
No, that is not the ordered list. I don't have a slide. There is something called the redox tower that we teach in biochemistry that has the redox potentials of lots of relevant electron donors and lots of electron acceptors. And basically the amount of energy you get out depends on how far apart your donor and your acceptor are. And so organisms will like to maximize that, but depending on the environments they live in, their choices will be restricted. Okay, is there hydrogen gas around? Is there oxygen around? Hydrogen sulfide?
The question. The nitrate and the nitrite ions are already negatively charged. So we have written that. So that means they have excess electrons. So you are saying that they are electron acceptors?
Yes.
In the compound phase or in the ionized phase?
Even in the ionized phase, because the oxidation state of nitrogen in nitrate is +5. And in nitrite, it's +3. So that means you can, for example, if you dump 2 electrons onto nitrate, you can reduce it to nitrite.
So you're saying they could take more electrons in addition to the charge?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because the charge is mostly localized on the oxygens. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the oxidation state of the nitrogen is actually changing. Okay. My undergraduates really hate these lectures. But I make them do it anyway because it is extremely important to understand how many ways there are for microbes to make a living in the environment. And most of them are doing it by redox, but they are doing it with, you know, different electron donors and different electron acceptors. Okay. So going back to methanogens, the oxidation state of carbon in CO2 is +4. In methane, CH4, the oxidation state is -4. So it actually takes 8 electrons going onto this carbon to reduce it to methane. This is just a fun video that shows, maybe. Let's see. These are methanogens below the seafloor, and those bubbles coming up are methane. And the methanogens are reducing CO2 in the seawater to methane and making those bubbles. Okay, so the whole point of this is just that there are many different reductants, electron donors, and many different oxidants, electron acceptors, that can be used to supply energy. Oh, now my slides look even worse. Okay, so I told you that the basic idea is that energy is captured from the environment and it is stored in the form of ATP. So the next thing I'm going to tell you about is how that actually happens. The other important player here is NADPH. The parentheses means that sometimes this molecule has a phosphate on it and sometimes it doesn't. So when it has a phosphate, it's NADPH. Okay. And NADPH is important because it is sort of the storage form for the electrons that are going to be used for biosynthesis. So these oxidation reactions will, of course, produce electrons that need to be donated to something, and that's going to be NADH. And then that will be converted to NADPH and used for biosynthetic reactions, which many of which require an input of electrons. Okay. Are you with me? Okay. All right, this is just a picture of ATP to remind you that the reason that chemical energy can be stored in ATP is that these bonds between the phosphates are high energy bonds. And what that means is that if you break those bonds by a hydrolysis, attack of water, it releases a lot of energy. Okay. So this is a way of storing chemical energy. And this is the structure of NAD or NADH, which stores electrons. So NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So a nucleotide is a base attached to a ribose sugar attached to a phosphate. So this is a mononucleotide. And since these things are connected by these two phosphate groups, this is a dinucleotide. So one of the nucleotides is adenine, which is normally found in RNA and DNA. The other one has this unusual base called nicotinamide. And the reason that this can serve as an electron storage device is that this nicotinamide ring can be reduced by adding two electrons and two protons, and that gives NADH. Okay? So you dump in two electrons, and then you have to protonate this position up here, and that gives you a place to store electrons for later use. Okay, so those are the two sort of key components that are going to be used for biosynthesis, for energy and for donating electrons. Okay? All right, so now the interesting question is, how do you actually capture all of this energy that can be released from redox reactions? So the energy from redox reactions is going to be captured in a proton gradient. And these are the components that I was talking about earlier that are involved in this process. And since this is kind of a scary slide, I'm going to just look at one of them first. Okay. So this is a protein complex called complex 1. It has about 40 different polypeptide chains in it. It's an enormous and complicated protein machine, essentially. And it takes electrons that are donated by NADH, and it is going to pass them through a series of electron carriers and dump them out on a molecule called a quinone. And in the process of doing this, protons get pumped across the membrane. And so what's happening here is that this is a redox reaction. NADH is the electron donor, and the quinone is the electron acceptor. It's a downhill reaction, and that energy is then used to drive the transport of protons across the membrane. And so what we're going to end up with is now energy stored in a proton gradient rather than in a molecule.
So is it understood about this particular mechanism, how the redox reaction is like coupled to
proton pumps?
It is. Yes, it is. And each one of these complexes has a different mechanism, and they're pretty complicated. So I'm not going to tell you the details. But I did want to sort of strip away. So this looks like it's all protein. Okay, but in fact, embedded in this protein are a whole bunch of iron-sulfur clusters. And that's where the electrons actually travel. Okay, so there are two iron 2 sulfur 2 clusters and seven iron 4 sulfur 2 clusters. And the electrons come in from NADH up here. They are transferred, well, actually, they're showing you here in black is NAD, overlaying on a flavin. So flavins are also cofactors that have aromatic rings. And flavins are the transducers between two electron chemistry and one electron chemistry. So NADH actually donates a hydride. So that's H minus, two electrons and one proton. Flavins can accept a hydride, but then they can feed out one electron at a time. And that's critical because these iron sulfur clusters can only take one electron at a time. So you need this flavin transducer to take the two electrons coming in and then feed out one at a time. And these electrons then travel through the protein, from cluster to cluster, and then they end up being donated to an electron acceptor, the quinone, at the other side of the protein. Okay, questions in there?
The quinone is in the membrane?
So these are the quinones. Okay. So the quinone part is actually this part right here. So it's the six-membered ring with two double bonds here and a double bond there. And quinones can accept two electrons and two protons. They are freely soluble in the membrane because they have these long hydrocarbon tails. So they're mobile.
Just like very briefly, what's the gist of how this is coupled to hydrogen moving? I mean, is this it's a very abstract sense? Conformational?
There can be some conformational changes, but usually what it involves is taking up a proton on the outside of the membrane, on the inside of the membrane, and then through all of these electron transfer reactions, a proton ends up getting released at the other side.
So, to continue on this remark, so those protons that are pumped through the membrane, are they the one that will appear when you write down the redox reactions? Like you have some, you write some oxidant plus Z electrons give the reductants, and you equilibrate with the protons. Mm-hmm. Are these the one that could be traveling through the membrane? Or
It's not necessarily that it's the same proton that goes across the membrane.
But it's a result of...
Yeah. Okay, so I should have put in some... I should have put in the beautiful mechanism slide. I thought it would make your head spin. So. Well, it would, but you might have liked it.
Can I ask?
Sure.
Just to make sure I understood, perhaps it's the same question, but I'm a bit slow. So the proton is transported outside the cell, and where, at the end of the day, where does the electron go? Does it stay on the membrane, or
the proton?
The electron.
Oh, the electron. Ah, no, the electron actually goes to the quinone.
But if this keeps happening, are these electrons accumulated there?
Okay, so now let's go through the whole picture.
Okay, so
This is the complex I showed you before.
Yeah. Now, I have another question, which may be simpler. Are you talking about a specific organism, or is it this concerned eukaryotes?
This stuff is pretty much conserved in all organisms.
Okay,
thanks. This last one is what Dan was talking about. So I'll mention what happens with this. So this is the one I showed you before. It gets electrons delivered by NADH, and it passes them to a quinone and reduces the quinone. Okay? There are actually two ways, so this is called the electron transport chain. And there are two ways of feeding electrons into this. Okay, one of them is from NADH, which is what I just showed you. The other one is called complex 2, and it's a little more boring because it doesn't transport protons across the membrane, but it does get electrons into the system. And it specifically reacts with a molecule called succinate and oxidizes it, and those electrons also get delivered to a quinone. Okay, so one way or another, what we get out of these things is a mobile reduced electron carrier that can then diffuse around in the membrane, and it will get delivered to complex 3. So QH2 is the reduced form of the quinone, and Q is the oxidized form. Okay, so here we're going from the oxidized form to the reduced form. Same thing here, Q is going to QH2. Now, this is the answer to your question. Now those electrons are going to get delivered to another complex, complex 3. It also has an array of electron carriers embedded in that protein that you can't see right now. It also transports protons across the membrane. And the electrons, now, they were donated by a reduced quinone, and the quinone is now oxidized. Now what happens is that these electrons are donated to a protein called cytochrome C. Cytochrome C has a heme, and at the center of the heme is an iron atom. And that iron atom can accept an electron. It's not soluble in the membrane anymore, but it is soluble. So this is actually, I think I put my inside and outside wrong, sorry. I was doing this last night and I said, you know, I should tell them which is the inside and the outside. You could flip that around. This is the inside. So cytochrome C is this small protein, and it's now going to take an electron and it's going to deliver it to complex 4.
Does cytochrome C, does it have to, like, is there some like specific binding site on complex 3 where it has to, so it has to
it'll dock, get that electron delivered, and then it'll depart and bring the electron to complex 4. Okay, complex 4 is now where we're going to get rid of those electrons. So in complex 4, oxygen is the terminal electron acceptor in this picture, and oxygen is going to get reduced to water. So that will take 2 electrons for each 1/2 O2. So cytochrome C will be delivering electrons to this complex 4, and then they will be dumped on to O2. And in that process, also, protons are going to be pumped across the membrane.
So and it's a similar thing. It's not just that cytochrome 3, cytochrome C has to be nearby. It's actually like there's some like tight state that you can like crystallize of those two guys bound to each other for complex 4. It's just really like a
So it's going to have a specific docking site here, too. Yeah. So it's going to be soluble in the cytoplasm, so it can move from one to the other, but it's going to be able to actually dock and bind to receive an electron here and then to donate an electron here. Okay. So now this is where things get different with organisms that, say, live in anoxic environments and they don't ever see O2. They'll have different kinds of proteins in this part of the electron transport chain so that they can dump their electrons on different oxidants that aren't oxygen.
I'm getting confused again, so maybe can you define inside and outside? Because what isn't that actually the outside? Correct.
Oh, wait, let me see. All right.
Or is this a mitochondria?
Here's the problem. Yes, I was trying to avoid talking about mitochondria.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I was trying to generalize this to bacteria. So this picture is actually from a depiction of what happens in the mitochondria of eukaryotic cells, which are basically endosymbiotic bacteria. And so this would be the this would be the cytoplasm of the cell. This would be the inside of the mitochondria.
NADH is on the inside of the mitochondria.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
The labeling is correct if that were the mitochondrial.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
This is the outer membrane of the mitochondria.
Yes, it's the outer membrane.
This is the inner membrane.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I've heard of alternate oxidases. Is that refer to alternate complex forms?
Yeah. Other kinds of complexes that can, for example, take nitrate or nitrite or iron.
Do organisms tend to have, are they plastic? They have a plastic oxygen?
Many of them are. So, for example, E. coli can use O2 as a terminal electron acceptor, or it can use nitrate. Some of them can use nitrate and nitrite. So yes, they are. They can be plastic in terms of which terminal complexes they express, and they'll adjust that according to what's available in the environment.
And do those have a shared evolutionary history? Like, are they derived from each other, or are they independent origins of? I mean, because this is like a complex thing.
It's a very
complex thing. Like
no, I actually do not know the answer for that question.
Yeah, I've been hearing more about these alternative oxidases and kind of wondering where they come from.
And I don't know. It's a very, really interesting question.
Like, you know, if it's just one subunit that gets modified, or whether the whole
Yeah, you would think that you could just modify one subunit, but I don't know if that's,
seems that's like a very
true.
Complex
so
machine,
so. I'm not going to say. But I think it's an interesting question. Greg?
I'm confused about my statement this was the outer membrane, because there's so much more surface area on the inner membrane. This is the inner membrane.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So one side's the matrix and the other side's the intramembrane.
Yes,
space.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I'm sorry I confused that so thoroughly.
So I'm looking at protons now. Mm-hmm. So NADH is NAD and a proton, right? So I know for Q we receive protons.
Mm-hmm.
Are they the same protons, or so how do protons work in this situation?
No, they're not the same protons. So Q is basically when it's picking up a couple of electrons. Every time it picks up an electron, it has to pick up a proton. So it grabs it from adjacent to the membrane. And then the next time it picks up, when it picks up its second electron, it picks up a second proton.
Right. So now what happens to the protons released by NADH?
They just diffuse into the cell. Nothing in particular.
Okay. Does the reactions like that significantly, apart from the pumping, just do those reactions themselves, like NADH goes to NADH protons, do that like depend a lot, affect pH a lot, or pH is like...
The inside of the cell is fairly well buffered. Yeah. Bruce?
Sorry, I'm a little confused. So that whole process is fed by the energy of oxidizing NADH, right?
Yes.
Ultimately, mm-hmm. right, that's where electrons ended up.
Yeah, so the total reaction is the oxidation of NADH by O2.
Right. So that's our energy budget.
Yes.
So I'm confused by the stoichiometry of moving protons, because these protons, now we're moving charges across the membrane,
mm-hmm.
we're charging that capacitor,
mm-hmm.
and we also have to worry about sort of balancing the charges, so right, we're building up some potential across, and presumably then once we charge this thing, we'll be running protons back through some synthases, right? But so
the whole point is to charge up the membrane.
But so here there is this stoichiometry specified, right? But presumably how many protons will be able to move across depends on the membrane potential, right? So if I somehow hook it up to an external battery and the charge it some more or less, that should affect the stoichiometry, no? Or I just don't understand that four there.
So that has to do with, and so I have to tell you, this is not my primary field of expertise, but there are very elaborate mechanisms for picking up protons at certain points and dumping them off at certain points, and exactly what governs the stoichiometry in each one of those complexes is pretty complicated, and I can't give you all of the details.
Yeah, I was at the risk of talking about stuff which I know nothing about. Like I just remember reading that, I know there's like what people call like the O to P ratio, right? How every oxygen, how many ATP do you get? And I guess that was controversial for a while, and then I think it does depend on the circumstance, like you're saying.
I think what you're saying is you get a buildup of that current. Like, let's just say you charge it externally, then what's happening to the electrons? So when I believe that when you get a really strong gradient, that's when you can start making free radicals. Those electrons actually jump out of the chain, and they, supercharge oxygen.
They make reactive oxygen species that can cause damage. Yeah.
But cells do have ways to dissipate the proton gradient through uncoupling proteins.
But there are many things that the proton gradient is actually used for. So it's used to drive motility in some cases. It's used for transport processes, and it's also for where I was going was it's used to make ATP.
Just a small comment. The entire electron transport chain, there are also experiments that show that the entire chain, and I think each one of these separately, are all reversible processes. So if you charge the membrane strong enough, you can actually drive them all backwards. So what actually does happen does depend on the exact membrane potential.
But the stoichiometry of those four protons moving is believed to be exact. There is no room for differences because it's exact conformational changes that lead to this, and according to all the measurements, it doesn't seem to change. But it's actually currently unknown what parts of the protein even do this.
And that, of course, is what I kind of find a mystery. Right? Because
so is there anybody here who can give a talk about this?
No, we can continue.
No, I would love to. Is there anybody who can talk about these details?
I think it's believed to be so that the structures of complex one, for example, they are only been known for a few years. So it's from all the measurements and from the structures, it's believed to be there are particular residues that pick up those protons, and after a conformational change that is induced by the redox reactions, there is exact number of protons that then show up on the other side, and there is no room for deviation from this number. That's if the potential is so different that it can't work anymore, it will just stop. But it will not start pumping three protons.
So the reaction rates will depend on.
Yeah, reaction rates will, but each step will
the
be.
To do.
Well, there are also homologs.
It's not just a matter of rates, right? It's not just total energy. Not just you burn one molecule and you move four protons, right? So you know across a fixed potential, so you know how much energy it takes to move four protons.
I think there are homologs of complex one, too, that pump different numbers of protons. So while this one is four, there are other ones so it doesn't have to be four. So depending on the exact conditions of the membrane potential, I think there are ways to adapt this so that it works out.
Okay, so I guess what you guys are telling me is that, of course, energy conservation, we know for a long time, right? So if energy is not conserved, it just won't pump, and it won't pump anything at all. I think that's what you say.
Yes.
I mean, it could be dissipating a lot of energy.
Well, precisely. Naively, I would say, okay, if you back it up, it will pump two protons instead of four, right? And then on average, it will come out to be some crazy number, right?
I would think of it more as an activation barrier type picture.
Precisely. I think what I'm hearing is that it will just shut off and condense electrons into free radicals and won't do anything at all.
It's also not completely true that there aren't other reactions. There are reactions that are like basically just slippage reactions that can happen, and they do occur. So it doesn't, when it's functioning properly, the stoichiometry, as you said, is exact, but there are side reactions that can happen that generally happen about an order or two magnitudes lower in flux. So there are other reactions that can happen.
Okay. All right. And we heard about this complex this morning. This is the complex that now uses this proton gradient to make ATP. Okay. So this is actually not the only way out there in nature to make ATP through redox reactions. There is a different strategy called fermentation, and this happens in organisms that don't have an electron transport chain or are not using their electron transport chain. And it's much less efficient, but it is a way of making ATP and capturing electrons. And what has to happen then is, instead of NADH donating electrons to the electron transport chain, where it can sort of maximize the amount of energy that the organism is getting out of it, the NADH is used to reduce some small organic molecule, and then that reduced product is basically a waste product. So instead of taking your carbon and going all the way to CO2 with it and getting maximal amount of energy out of it, you're dumping these electrons onto something and generating waste products. So it's less efficient, but it is a way of operating when there is no oxidant available in the environment.
And similarly, like are these coenzymes also basically universally conserved, or is that not?
So this is part of glycolysis.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And the enzymes that are involved in the fermentation reactions actually are not necessarily conserved. So there are quite a few different fermentation products that can be made by different organisms. And that's how you get actually all of the interesting flavors in like sourdough bread and sauerkraut and soy sauce and beer and wine. All of those are fermentation products, and different organisms will choose different small molecules to dump their electrons on.
But the core, like if you look at all sorts of weird bugs, like the core of glycolysis is still there.
The core of glycolysis is pretty universal. Yes. Yeah. It's just what they're going to dump the excess electrons on. If they're not using the electron transport chain, they can use different small molecules as electron acceptors. Okay. I love this, but it always gets groans. This is a summary of most of what we know about metabolic pathways. It's not everything. It's also most of what we know in most organisms, and it doesn't have a lot of, you know, the extra weird things. But it is obviously pretty complicated. And some of this is catabolic, which means degrading carbon compounds, and some of it is anabolic, which is biosynthetic pathways. Okay, so what we're seeing here is all of the types of chemical transformations that go on inside cells. This is a little simpler way to look at this. So heterotrophs are organisms that can oxidize organic compounds to get their carbon. And what happens is that there are many different pathways for funneling lots of different carbon sources in the environment into a core that is highly conserved in all organisms. And out of that core are pathways for building the building blocks for macromolecules, so proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, also things like secondary metabolites that are used to manipulate competitors in the environment. So you can think of this as a funnel going into core metabolism and then things spreading out from there. Autotrophs are self-feeding organisms. They are the ones that can fix CO2 and make their own carbon, and they directly fix CO2, feed it into this core. Okay, so that's a sort of little simpler view of the process. So if you, I'm going to go back to that, the idea of that big picture, and there are three kinds of features that you can see in that network. Okay, cycles, pathways, and local networks. So one example of a cycle is the citric acid cycle, also called the tricarboxylic acid cycle, also called the Krebs cycle. And it is a path, a cycle that takes acetyl-CoA, which is a product of glycolysis, and that has, the acetyl group has two carbons, and those carbons are going to get completely oxidized to CO2. And in that, those are oxidation reactions. That means there are going to be electrons generated, and they get stored in the form of NADH. And there is also a step here that generates GTP, which can be interconverted with ATP. Okay, so there are a few cycles in that complicated network. There are a lot of pathways that are mostly linear, although this one has two branches coming together to make this compound. And then there are some sort of local networks. So this is the network of sugar metabolism, and this is really the conserved core of metabolism. So the, in green is glycolysis. In yellow is the pentose phosphate pathway, which is, and I'll come back to this in more detail later, but pentoses, such as ribose, are synthesized in this yellow part. This is an alternative pathway for oxidizing glucose that is found in some bacteria. And then here is this TCH cycle. Okay, so this is really the core of metabolism. Okay, so one of the important things to realize about this network is that almost every reaction in this network is catalyzed by an enzyme. Okay, so we've been talking about mostly thermodynamics. Now we're going to start talking about kinetics.
Excuse me. Do you know how they map that pathway?
That's many decades of people working out this goes to this, goes to this, and assigning which enzymes they're doing what.
This was theoretically done, and then
no, this is all, this is experimental. Completely experimental. Hundreds of person years of effort into that. And Boris?
On that big chart, you notice that this is almost all that we know. Is there any way of estimating what fraction we know of what's out there?
That, I don't know how to estimate that fraction, because we don't know what we don't know, right?
You know, so people sequence some random bacteria. Is there some way of asking sort of how saturated the sampling is when we find a new gene?
So even E. coli,
the probability that it's homologous to something.
Okay, even E. coli, which is the best studied bacterium, there are something like 35 to 40% of genes for which we don't know a function. If we sequence the genome of a brand new bacterium, what people do is they find the genes and then they look for things that are related to them to try to assign a function. That can be quite dangerous, because even proteins that are 90% identical can sometimes have different functions. But that's pretty much what, I mean, that's what is computationally possible to suggest the function of genes. But then you always end up with a certain number of genes that don't match anything of known function. Sometimes you find genes that don't match anything, period. So I'd say that we are very far from saturating our knowledge, but I can't say what, I think there's a lot of unknown out there.
Okay,
but it's one of those unknown unknowns.
I'm just curious if we by now have enough information about the, let's say, genes of 90% homology having the same metabolic function or different metabolic function.
Okay. So
is
usually...
Is statistics to say that with... if you are at 95% homology, you're whatever 60% likely to have the same function.
First, let me climb on my soapbox. You can't say 90% homology. That's like being 90% pregnant. Homology means related.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. 90% identical. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox. I torture my students with this. At 90% identity, you're pretty likely to have the right function, but you're not guaranteed. Particularly for enzymes, where you can have 90% identity, that there can be changes in the active site that change substrate specificity. But you can get a lot of information about lifestyle from those kinds of computational predictions. You can say, oh, it has an electron transport chain. Oh, it's got a bunch of transporters. It has these kinds of signaling mechanisms. So you can get a long way, but you can never get everything in any bacterial genome correctly assigned computationally.
And there are plenty of examples of non-orthologous gene replacement pathways, so that's more similar to genes at all, but they have the same function.
That's right, yeah. So there are cases where completely unrelated genes will serve the same function, and if you're searching for this gene, it won't match. So you may be completely fooled.
So there are genomics and there are metabolomics. Mm-hmm. It's like, but in terms of metabolomics, is that, do you think we are like know kind of more about it? Compared to genomics? For example, this pathway is more metabolism.
Yeah, metabolomics is actually a couple of decades behind genomics because it's so much harder to do. And there are many more unknowns. So when you do a metabolomics experiment, you get all kinds of masses for ions that you don't even know what they are. So it's one of the most exciting new fields, but it's behind genomics.
I have a conceptual question which might help me for the rest of my 3 weeks here. As you just transitioned from talking about electron transport chain to these sort of metabolic enzymes, you said that was all thermodynamics and this is kinetics. Mm-hmm. Are the enzyme complexes of electron transport chain, are they not considered enzymes that have kinetics that facilitate those reactions the way that these types of metabolic enzymes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in a sort of broad sense they are enzymes because they are catalyzing transfer of protons across a membrane. I think of, most people don't call transport as enzymes, but I consider them enzymes because they catalyze the transport of one thing. So, if you want to keep a very narrow definition of enzymes, it would be, changing, breaking and making bonds. But I consider enzymes anything that catalyzes a process.
So related to like the activation energy, like they lower the activation energy for any of these reactions?
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment about our knowledge. I guess if you take like organisms that we know a lot about or more about, like humans or E. coli, I would say we probably know the vast majority of the enzymes and they catalyze the reactions between abundant metabolites. Mm-hmm. Like we know how all of the amino acids are synthesized, we know most of the enzymes that generate energy. And
yeah, it's more the sort of peripheral things like making secondary metabolites or degrading weird things in the environment. Those are the things that we know less about. Okay, so I said enzymes are extremely important because life would not exist without catalysis, and this is a nice explanation of why catalysts are so important. These are all biological reactions, and the fastest of these has a half-life of 2 days, and the slowest has a half-life of 1.1 billion years. And this is a reaction that is required for synthesis of nucleotides. Okay, so without catalysts, we would not have life. So catalysts are, what I'm mainly talking about is the function of catalysts in metabolism, but I just want to point out that catalysts are involved in almost every process that cells do. Replicating the genome, transcribing DNA into RNA, translating RNA into protein, all kinds of regulatory interactions that are post-translational modifications like phosphorylating proteins, transport, which I just talked about, and movement. So catalysts are involved in pretty much everything. So now I want to do a sort of quick run through about how enzymes catalyze reactions, and then I'm finally going to get to, I hope, a story about some research. Okay, so there are four tricks that enzymes use to catalyze reactions: approximation, transition state stabilization, acid-base catalysis, and metal ion catalysis. So approximation just means that enzymes bring the reactants together close together and also at the right angles so that the highest occupied molecular orbital of one reactant can overlap with the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital of the other one. So basically, you have to get the orbitals in the right place. So it's not just bring them together, it's bring them together in the proper geometry. So this is a crystal structure of a protein kinase in tan, and it has bound to it a peptide that mimics its natural substrate. And this stuff here is actually an analog of ATP. So you can't crystallize a protein or an enzyme with its substrates because the substrates will just turn over. So typically what people do is they use some kind of analog. So this is, instead of ATP, it's AMP-PNP. So this blue is a nitrogen atom that replaces the oxygen atom that would normally be there. So this is a phosphate, phosphate, phosphate of ATP, but it will not transfer phosphate because it has a nitrogen here. This is the amino acid that is going to receive the phosphate on the substrate, and it is perfectly situated to attack this terminal phosphate and displace ADP. Okay, so this is an example of approximation, just bringing things together in the right orientation. All right, another thing that enzymes do is that they stabilize transition states. Okay, so this is your standard transition state theory that I think I can assume everybody is good with? Yes? Okay. So this is the barrier you have to get over. This is the kinetic part of the picture. And what enzymes will do is lower that energy needed to get over the barrier, often by, so they bind the substrate and then they stabilize the transition state so that the reaction is accelerated. So here's an example of how that happens. This is a cartoon of an enzyme active site for a protease, and this protease is going to cleave this carbon-nitrogen bond here. And it's going to do it using the side chain of a serine. So this hydroxyl side chain is going to attack this carbon. And the two electrons that are forming this new carbon-oxygen bond, if you push two electrons onto a carbon, you have to push two electrons off. Okay, so those two electrons then are going to go up onto this oxygen. Okay, so what these arrows mean are two electrons moving. Do not ever write arrows for protons moving. It's bad. Arrows always mean electrons are moving. Okay, so after this new carbon-oxygen bond is formed and those two electrons are pushed up onto the O minus, the enzyme has what's called an oxyanion hole. So it's got, these are backbone amide residues of the protein, So it's an NH and an NH, and both of those are pointed right into the site where this O minus is going to land. And that will electrostatically stabilize the transition state. So instead of having, so basically, localized charges are high energy. If you can either delocalize them or have an electrostatic interaction with a positive charge, it will stabilize the transition state. So this is one example of how an enzyme stabilizes a transition state. Every enzyme is different, and every enzyme has sort of different active site characteristics that will stabilize the transition state.
Yeah, I have a question. By definition, transition states are metastable, right?
Right.
I mean, they're not meant to be stable. So are you saying that, but there must be, what you call the stabilization is actually providing a pathway to form a transition state?
Because no, it is stabilizing that the transition state.
Which means you would not have a reaction though, right? By definition, if transition state is stable.
It means that the barrier is lower for the reaction, so the reaction will go faster. Okay, another thing that enzymes do is that they can do general acid and general base catalysis. So that term general acid and general base means that it's not protons and it's not hydroxide. And the point here is that by manipulating the protonation state of molecules, you can accelerate reactions. So this is a classical example of general base catalysis, where you have a base that is pulling a proton off of water, which makes water more like hydroxide, so it's more reactive, and it can now attack this carbon to form this tetrahedral intermediate, which can then break down and cleave this carbon-oxygen bond. So this reaction is much faster if a base pulls the proton off of the water than it is if it's just water by itself. Okay? Is that okay? Okay. You can also use general acid catalysis. And so in this case, what we're doing is, rather than pulling a proton off the water, we're donating a proton to this oxygen. So instead of getting O minus, we're going to get OH. Okay? That basically is pulling electron density away from this carbon, making it easier to attack by water. So you can either make the water more reactive, or you can make this C double bond O more reactive. Okay. Now, one of the great things about enzymes is they can actually do both things at the same time. So in an active site of an enzyme, you can have a base pulling a proton off the water and an acid donating a proton up here. And this is very unlikely to happen in solution because you would have to bring together four different molecules in the right orientation to make that happen. But enzymes, because they have these complex active sites, can do all of these things. So I'm getting short on time. The point of this is that enzymes can do many different kinds of catalysis. So here's just the first step of one particular reaction. It involves general base catalysis, forming an intermediate that's stabilized by an oxygen ion hole, and then the next step is general acid catalysis. Okay, and finally, about 40% of enzymes use metal ions to catalyze reactions. And they use metals in two ways. One is a Lewis acid. Okay, now a Lewis acid is not a proton donor, which is what you probably normally think of as an acid. What Lewis acids do is they basically just pull electron density away from a reacting atom. And then some metals do redox chemistry. So I'm just going to show you one example here, beta-lactamases, which hydrolyze beta-lactam antibiotics. and are a major cause of antibiotic resistance, have actually two zinc ions at the active site. And what those zinc ions do is, before the substrate binds, they coordinate a hydroxide, which is going to attack the beta-lactam antibiotic. This is a beta-lactam antibiotic. And when it binds, this carbonyl, the C double bond O, is coordinated to this zinc ion. And what that does is this positive charge pulls electron density away from this carbon and makes the hydroxide ion better able to attack. Okay, so that's Lewis acid catalysis. And then there are redox enzymes that use metal ions to change the oxidation states of their substrates. Okay, so I'm going to skip this part and turn to the question of, well, how did all of this evolve? Which is a question that fascinates me. Okay, so the Earth formed about 4.6 billion years ago, and it was not a very hospitable place for quite a while. But within about 600 million years, the Earth cooled enough to allow water to form. And this is the time when life emerged on Earth. So we know some things about the last universal common ancestor of all life just by tracing what kinds of genes are present in extant organisms. And the assumption is that if a gene is present in bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes, it probably came from the last universal common ancestor. So we know, of course, that the last universal common ancestor was microbial. We know it had ribosomes, made proteins, had a cell wall, and it had the core biosynthetic pathways for making amino acids and nucleotides. We can guess that it had on the order of 670 genes. And since the last common ancestor, genomes have gotten a lot bigger. So E. coli has over 4,000 genes. Humans have about 20-some thousand, and we are dwarfed by grapes that have 30,000. So, and evolution continues today in response to the introduction of pharmaceuticals and anthropogenic compounds like explosives and pesticides. So, I'm interested in the question of the origin of new genes, but I'm not going to tell you that today because I'm getting very short on time. I'm going to go straight to my favorite topic, which is promiscuity. And where I'm going with this is, how do new genes evolve, and particularly how do new metabolic pathways evolve? Okay. So my lab has been studying the concept of enzyme promiscuity for a few decades now, and I want to give you my definition of this, which is that promiscuity is the ability to catalyze adventitious secondary reactions that are physiologically irrelevant. This is probably not the definition of promiscuity you're most familiar with, even if you think about enzymes. A lot of people refer to promiscuous enzymes as enzymes that have multiple substrates. And I don't like that definition because it doesn't tell you whether those reactions are physiologically relevant or not. I think it's important to distinguish between things that are just accidents of active sites and things that actually contribute to the fitness of the organism. So there are many examples of enzymes that serve multiple physiological functions. For example, the glutathionase transferases in your liver that detoxify lots of different things that you ingest in your diet. So those are cases where I would not call that promiscuity. I would call that polyspecificity. Okay, promiscuity, in my mind, are the accidental reactions that have no impact on fitness.
Maybe this is a question that you would answer in the next couple of minutes, but how can you be sure it's an accident?
In some cases, you can't. In some cases, you can be sure because the enzyme never actually sees that substrate. So you can detect promiscuous activities in vitro that you can be sure promiscuous because the organism never produces that that compound. Or it could be that the organism produces that compound but never in the same place at the same time. Or you could have a very inefficient activity that corresponds to another enzyme that is very efficient in the same organism. And that enzyme is really doing the job. This one's accidental. But sometimes you can't tell. Okay. This is my son. He was about 15 when I was explaining promiscuity to him. I get it. It's when enzymes cheat on their substrates. Promiscuous enzyme reactions are extremely common. We used to think that enzymes were very specific, and mainly that's because we didn't think to test them for reactions with hundreds of substrates. Here is an interesting example of a profiling experiment of 200 enzymes versus 167 substrates, and every place you see red is where the enzyme could turn over the substrate. And there are some of these enzymes that can turn over 100 different substrates. Okay. Surely not all of those are actually physiologically relevant.
It doesn't include the rate, right? That's just saying.
No.
So some of those
can be. No, no. Some of them are very inefficient, but these are just, it will turn over the substrate.
So there's a cutoff for what you consider, how long you're willing to wait to see it.
Yes. Right. Exactly.
Sorry, what do you say they are not, surely they are not relevant?
Oh, because I really don't think that any enzyme actually catalyzes 100 different physiologically relevant reactions in an organism. So in some cases, it will never see the substrate. In some cases, it's going to be too inefficient to matter. Okay, so, you know, based on this, you know, we don't know. Obviously, some enzymes have much broader specificity than others, but one of the things that I take from this is that if you just think about the number of enzymes that are typically in bacteria or microbes, there are generally between 1,000 and 2,000 enzymes. If each one of those had just 10 promiscuous activities, then say E. coli might have 16,000 promiscuous activities available to it. So why would you care if they're physiologically irrelevant? The reason is that even inefficient promiscuous activities can accelerate chemical reactions by orders of magnitude. So this is E. coli alkaline phosphatase. This is not its native substrate, actually. It is a broad specificity enzyme that will cleave a lot of phosphate esters. But it has a kcat over km, which is the second order rate constant for the reaction of the enzyme and the substrate, of 3 times 10 to the 7th per molar per second. Alkaline phosphatase has promiscuous activities to cleave sulfate esters and phosphodiesters, and it is much less effective. But if we look at proficiency, which is the ratio of the catalyzed kcat over km to the uncatalyzed rate constant, for the physiological phosphatase reaction, the enzyme accelerates the reaction by 17 orders of magnitude. That is not even the record. The most proficient enzyme known accelerates a reaction by 26 orders of magnitude. But notice that even these inefficient promiscuous reactions are accelerated by 9 and 11 orders of magnitude. So what that means is that these inefficient promiscuous activities provide a reservoir of catalytic potential. If, for example, cleavage of a sulfate ester became important for fitness, then this enzyme could be recruited to do that new job and would right off the bat provide 9 orders of magnitude of rate acceleration. So the reason we care about promiscuous reactions is that they provide a starting point for evolution of new enzymes.
So how does this number compare to the native enzyme that actually catalyzes this reaction?
So a native enzyme that catalyzes this reaction would be the average value for kcat over km for metabolic enzymes is about 10 to the fifth per molar per second. That's a quite good enzyme. 10 to the third per molar per second is also, is fine. Okay, so these are much lower.
Yes. So what about its relevance then compared to the native enzyme? It's an order of, even though the proficiency looks high, so, but it's still eight orders of magnitude lower.
Right. So these are promiscuous activities. They are irrelevant for fitness, but they could become relevant for fitness and provide the starting point for evolution of a new enzyme. Okay. So, and the way that typically works is that if that inefficient promiscuous activity becomes important, there will be selective pressure to maintain duplicate or multiple copies of the gene, and each copy will then start picking up mutations stochastically, and eventually one of them may diverge to an efficient specialist enzyme for this formerly inefficient activity that now became important. Okay, so this is the model for how new enzymes evolve from promiscuous activities. Okay.
Is it a subset of the neofunctionalization?
It's not neofunctionalization because it's, so neofunctionalization was an old idea that, I skipped that part. Going back to Ono in the 1970s, who proposed that a gene could duplicate and then one copy could acquire a new function. And the problem with that model is that the most likely thing to happen to a gene duplicate is that it will acquire a mutation that kills the protein. This is, Mike has done some very nice work on this question.
But I guess I don't see that could still happen here initially. You have redundant function.
So, but it's not neofunctionalization because the newly needed function is already there when the process starts. It's just inefficient.
Sort of extreme form of subfunctionalization.
This is also, it is like subfunctionalization. It really is subfunctionalization. You have a good function and you have an inefficient function and you're going to divide them.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. The pathways you chose does not have this kind of multi-substrates on it, right? You were showing a metabolic
path. Oh, pathways. I was just showing you
this,
the physiological.
It could bifurcate or try.
Oh, yeah. So promiscuous activities basically make a real mess out of your whole conception of the metabolic network because it looks like a nice wiring diagram or plumbing diagram, but in reality there are little leaks everywhere.
That's right.
Okay, so it's a total mess. People don't like to think about it. But thinking about it, so promiscuous activities provide the starting point for evolution of new enzymes, but they can also provide the starting point for evolution of new metabolic pathways. So you can imagine patching together promiscuous activities from various places in the metabolic network to create a new metabolic pathway. And that's essentially what you're talking about. So you can have a leak and another leak and another leak and another leak, and you can get from here to here.
And that could cascade back and change the other loops as well, right? Some downstream, if it bifurcated into a different substrate, the products coming out of it could actually be inhibitors for other.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay, so where I've been trying to go is, so how do new metabolic pathways evolve? This is the basic idea for how we think metabolic pathways evolve, but there are so many things that we don't know about this. We have very little information about what organism a new metabolic pathway might have arisen in, what was its genome content at the time a pathway arose, what environment did it live in, and what kinds of mutations were required to patch together a new metabolic pathway. So we can get some clues about some of these things from the lifestyles of extant organisms and their genome contents, but basically the details of the process are lost in time. So we use experimental evolution in the laboratory to try to answer some of these kinds of questions. So this, I'm going to tell you a story about the evolution of the new metabolic pathway in the lab in E. coli, and this paper just came out and it was edited by Mike Lynch. Thank you, Mike. Okay, so this story started quite a few years ago when we were, we went on an unbiased genome-wide search for promiscuous activities. This is otherwise known as a fishing expedition. And we were using a technique called multi-copy suppression. And what that means is that you have a phenotype and you can make it go away by expressing genes at very high levels on a multi-copy plasmid. So the strategy was to take a strain of E. coli that lacked a gene that was essential for growth under some set of conditions and to put in a library of plasmids, each of which contained a single gene from E. coli. Okay, so this is a high copy plasmid and it has a very strong promoter. And the idea is that if one of these genes encodes a promiscuous enzyme that corresponds to the missing enzyme, if you make a lot of it, then the cells will live. Okay? So then you can find colonies on a plate and you can isolate the plasmid, sequence this insert, and find out which gene restored growth of this deletion strain. So this was a way of trying to fish out promiscuous activities. Okay. So the most interesting result we got was from an enzyme that, or a strain that lacked an enzyme called PDXB, which is erythronate 4-phosphate dehydrogenase. It oxidizes this alcohol to a carbonyl in the pathway for synthesis of pyridoxal phosphate, which is vitamin B6. So vitamin B6 is essential for all life on Earth. It participates in catalysis of many different chemical transformations, including all of the transaminases that make amino acids for protein synthesis. So it is an essential cofactor. This is actually the pathway that I showed you early on. This is PDXB up here in the yellow box. And the major thing I wanted to emphasize with this is that there is also a salvage pathway. So E. coli can take up a precursor of PLP called pyridoxine from the medium and convert it to PLP. And that this will be important in some of the results I'm going to show you. So the interesting thing was when we did this multi-copy suppression experiment with a strain that lacked PDXB, so that's what the delta PDXB means, that PDXB has been deleted, we got 7 different genes that would restore growth. So this is the positive control here. So if we put PDXB itself back on the plasmid, the cells will grow in 2 days. This is the negative control. If we have no gene expressed on the plasmid, nothing happens in 7 days. And in all 7 of these cases, these genes would suppress the phenotype. They would allow the cells to grow. But what was odd was that this was a very motley collection of enzymes. So PDXB is a dehydrogenase. You might expect that dehydrogenase, other dehydrogenases in E. coli might be able to substitute for PDXB. But I would never expect a kinase or a dehydratase or a hydrolase to substitute for dehydrogenase. They just don't do the right kind of chemistry. And in fact, none of these enzymes actually has the missing activity, which is what we were looking for. That's odd. Okay, after scratching our heads for a while, what we figured out was, what was going on was that we weren't replacing the missing enzyme. We were essentially rerouting metabolism. So by overexpressing some other enzyme in the metabolic network, we were pulling material out of someplace else and patching it through a new pathway. And these steps are catalyzed by promiscuous enzymes. So we call these serendipitous pathways because of the sort of fortuitous nature of patching together multiple promiscuous activities. So we've figured out, actually 9 years ago, one of these pathways. So it pulls material out of serine biosynthesis and patches it through four steps into the PLP synthesis pathway downstream of the break. And for lack of time, I'm just going to buzz through this. We know the first enzyme in the pathway, the second step is non-enzymatic, the third step is catalyzed by a sort of polyspecific enzyme of unknown function, and the fourth step is catalyzed by a promiscuous kinase. Okay, so this pathway requires three promiscuous activities and one non-enzymatic activity. But it works.
So you're saying that this is always there, but the flux for this you think is very low, and then you kind of overexpress one guy and
exactly.
The flux
is there. Yeah. Okay. So if you overexpress this first enzyme, it's like opening the faucet and allowing material to flow into the pathway. If you overexpress this last enzyme, it pulls material through the pathway. Because this is actually coupled to phosphoryl transfer from ATP. So you can make this work by either pushing or pulling on the pathway. Okay. All right. So these two enzymes were involved in that pathway. These other five enzymes seem to be involved in at least two other pathways. So there are multiple ways to do this.
Just out of curiosity, you've got five or six examples that worked. How big was the library that you tested? What percentages are we talking about?
So it was almost every metabolic enzyme in E. coli. So that would have been, it was probably 600 to 800 enzymes.
Okay, so like 6 out of 600.
Yeah. Okay. But what we realized was that this is actually not a very physiologically relevant thing to do, because if you overexpress a gene on a plasmid with a copy number of 300 with an extremely strong promoter, you're going to make more enzyme than you could ever get by something like a promoter mutation or gene duplication amplification. So we decided not to go after any more of those pathways from the multi-copy suppression angle. We decided to see if we could get E. coli to evolve a new pathway just with mutations. Okay. So the idea was to do just a classic serial transfer experiment. Put the bacteria in a medium containing glucose as the sole carbon source, so it has to make PLP, and then keep doing serial transfers. This is like the Linsky experiment, over and over and over and over until you're students rebel. The problem in this case is that if you delete PDXB, these cells can't make PLP, and so they shouldn't grow. So this experiment should not work. Fortunately, my postdoc tried it anyway. So he put the strain that lacked PDXB in glucose as the sole carbon source, and he let it sit there and think about it for about 10 days, and he got a little bit of turbidity, which meant that something was growing. And at that point, he started doing this experiment, and he carried it out for up to about 150 generations, and he got multiple lineages that could now grow on E. coli almost as well as wild type. Could grow on glucose, sorry. So black is wild type E. coli, and all of these other curves are strains that he got within 150 generations. And you can see that they They have different lag phases for a reason that I understand, but I'm not going to tell you. But their growth rates are nearly as good as wild-type E. coli. 150 generations.
So it's so fun that the growth rates are always the same. Mm-hmm. Would you guess that under some kind of the appropriate orthogonal stress, one of them will do better than the others?
Under what?
Appropriate orthogonal stresses.
Appropriate what kind of stresses?
Orthogonal.
Orthogonal? Oh, okay. Yeah, this is all in glucose, 0.4% glucose. They very likely, I'm sure they will do differently in different growth conditions because they have all collected different collections of mutations. So we have asked how the evolved strains are making PLP and how mutations have improved PLP synthesis. And since it's getting late, I'm only going to address the first question. So we studied most intensely one of these strains, JK1, stands for Juhan Kim 1, postdoc. This strain makes wild-type levels of PLP. And it does it as a result of only four mutations. So the first thing we asked was, are they using this previously elucidated pathway? And to do that, we ask, do they require these enzymes to grow? And the answer is that they don't require this enzyme, which means they are not using this pathway, but they do require this enzyme, which suggests that maybe there is another way of making this intermediate. So what I'm going to tell you now is how we discovered a pathway that converts this compound to this compound. Okay, and it basically started with me sitting down and covering reams of paper with potential pathways until I came up with one that my postdoc was willing to test. One of the reviewers of the paper, I think, asked, how did you come up with this? And I was trying to figure out a way to say, well, it really just took convincing the postdoc to test it. So what happens is the first step in the pathway is cleavage of the phosphate off of this normal substrate for PDXB. The next step is oxidation of this alcohol to a carbonyl. And the next step is transamination of this alpha keto acid to an alpha amino acid. And then we are at a step that we already know. Okay. So what was appealing enough about this so that Juhan would test it was that it was short and that it involved common enzymatic transformations. Okay. So we haven't been able to figure out which phosphatase is responsible for this. E. coli has about 45 small molecule phosphatases, and there's just no way to make 45 knockouts and then all possible double knockouts and maybe even triple knockouts. So we don't know what phosphatase is responsible for that. But we do know that the next step is catalyzed by an enzyme called CERA, which is 3-phosphoglycerate dehydrogenase. It pulls material out of glycolysis and catalyzes the first step in synthesis of serine. We were interested in CERA because we had seen mutations in CERA in a few of these adapted strains. These are the genes in each strain that were mutated. JK1, as I said, has four mutations. So in four strains, we had mutations in CERA. We also knew that CERA catalyzed the right kind of chemistry. So CERA's normal function is oxidation of an alcohol to a carbonyl next to a carboxylate, and that's exactly the chemistry here. We also knew that serine would inhibit the growth of this strain. So in black is its normal growth. If we add serine to the medium, it turns up its toes and dies. But if we add pyridoxine, which can be converted to PLP by a salvage pathway, then it grows again, which tells us that serine is interfering with PLP synthesis. So the reason that that makes sense is actually CERA since it's the first enzyme in the pathway for synthesis of serine, is subject to feedback inhibition by serine. So if you add serine to the medium, it's going to shut down this enzyme. And if this enzyme has been recruited to make PLP, the cells won't grow. Okay. So in fact, in vitro, the enzyme has an inefficient activity with the substrate, in with the proposed substrate. But you always have to be very careful about translating things that you get in vitro to in vivo, because there are many things that happen in vitro that are irrelevant in vivo. So we did the in vivo experiment. We deleted serine and asked if the cells could grow. And they don't grow. This is a log scale, so this is basically noise. They don't grow. But of course they don't grow because they can't make serine. You give them serine, they still don't grow. But if you give them serine and pyridoxine, which can be converted to PLP by the salvage pathway, then they grow. Okay, so that tells us that in vivo, serine is responsible for this step in PLP synthesis. Okay, I'm going to just tell you that the same types of logic and in vitro and in vivo analysis allowed us to identify CRC as being responsible for this step. CRC is actually catalyzing a very similar reaction in PLP synthesis. Okay. And again, there's in vitro and in vivo evidence for CRC. Okay. So we now have a new metabolic pathway that has evolved within 150 generations as a result of four different mutations. And we do understand how the mutations actually allowed this to work, but that would take me more time, and it's too late, and I'm sure you're all tired of this by now. But one of the points that I really want to leave you with, I'm just going to go to the conclusions. This is all we know, how we know what happened. Okay, so the take-home points are that given that reservoir of promiscuous activities in the proteome, there are multiple ways to patch those things together to do new things. Okay, they provide a reservoir for evolution of individual new enzymes, but you can also patch them together in sequences to make new pathways. And there are multiple ways to do this. Remember that there were at least two others that I didn't talk about that were enabled by multi-copy suppression. One of the most interesting things I think that came out of this was that these serendipitous pathways, these new pathways, did not require mutations in the genes encoding enzymes in that pathway. So in all of these evolved strains, we saw mutations in CRA, which is involved in the pathway, in only four of them. None of these other mutations affected the enzymes in the pathway itself. What they did was alter the metabolic network in ways that allowed more material to flow through a serendipitous pathway. And I think that that is a pretty exciting finding. So you can construct a new metabolic pathway without touching the genes involved in that pathway. And finally, you can use very inefficient promiscuous activities to get this going. The kcat over km for CRA is only 0.07 per molar per second. For CRC, it's even lower than that. And I told you that 10 to the third is a respectable number. Now, of course, the cells don't need a lot of PLP, but in fact, every metabolic pathway had to have started at low flux. You know, nothing sprang into being with massive flux. So even very inefficient promiscuous activities can get the process started.
I was wondering if you saw any mutations in those enzymes that would accelerate its activity during your experiment?
No, only, so CRA in four strains, we saw mutations, four out of 13 strains. None of the other strains had mutations in any of these enzymes.
In the involved CRA strains, is the kcat or km different than in the wild type?
So in three of the evolved strains where we found mutations in CERE, they had lost that feedback inhibition by CERE. And so that provides effectively more activity for this new function because it's not being turned off by CERE. The fourth one, this activity went up a little bit and its native activity went down a little bit, which means that this new substrate is having better access to the active site.
This is a question from a person who knows no chemistry. Is it possible to turn this insight into some sort of a statistical model? So you gave us two examples.
This sounds like a Boris question, doesn't it?
You just gave us two examples of these, I think you call them serendipitous pathways mm-hmm. with three steps. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know any chemistry, but it sounds a little bit like a chess game to me. So try to modify some finite number of places on that molecule and move somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So can some blue gene or blue metabolism, deep learning, well, never mind deep learning, a computer just enumerate all the possible moves away from existing intermediate metabolites on that big chart and count all the possible bridges to other molecules?
So there have been some computational assessments of how you could get from here to here. And they have produced a frightening number of possibilities. I think, I'm trying to think, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but there's a pathway for synthesis of aromatic amino acids, and I think there were 11,000 possibilities or something. Now, the problem is
11,000 alternatives to existing paths.
Yeah. Okay, which is kind of ridiculous. I think that some of the reactions that were put into that model were not the kinds of things that enzymes typically catalyze. So it wasn't a particularly informed computation. But the bottom line is that there are many, many possibilities. Okay, so now my approach was to go back to retrosynthetic analysis, saying, here's where I want to get, how many ways can I think of to get there? And that's why I covered reams of paper. So I was essentially doing the computational experiment in my head and on the paper.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that it was so hard. This project took 9 years. And one of the reasons was it was so hard to get to a hypothesis for a pathway that was reasonable because I could draw so many possibilities. Now, in terms of actually making a statistical model, I could sit down with you and say, these are biologically relevant reactions, but what we don't know is for every enzyme in E. coli, 1,600 enzymes, what promiscuous activities do they have? So you don't necessarily even know what to feed into the model. So there have been these sort of naive, how many ways can I transform this into this? And the answer has been many. Very many.
Well, but I guess this is just begging for another statistical model of those promiscuous activities. Again, you keep it in your head, right? But then the question is...
It's not very efficient, though.
Can you teach the computer, 1% of what you know, right?
Yeah, so I would love to try something like that. The big impediment is that we have no idea how many promiscuous activities there are and what they are and how fast they are, how efficient they are. And even, one of the things that we're doing now is we're looking at, can we evolve things under different conditions? So like we grow the cells on acetate. The 400 genes go up, 400 genes go down. The collection of things that you can draw on is going to be different. So, what genes are expressed? What are the levels of the enzymes? What are the levels of the potential substrates? All of those things are going to influence what can happen. So it's kind of gruesome.
Yeah, I have a question. So the question is, Did you assess whether the energy barrier on the new pathway is the same as before? I mean, I probably missed that part, whether you ended up with the same products in the alternate pathways as the old one?
Yeah.
And you did?
Yeah, we ended up with the same level of POP as wild-type E. coli can make. But the energy barriers, so I told you those KCAT over KM values are very, very low. That means the energy barriers are actually higher.
Nice.
Yet, they're still able to produce enough, the normal amount of the product. Even though those enzymes are not as...
But the rates are not the same.
No, the rate...
I don't think they would be. But.
Well, okay. So the energy barrier is higher, but the rate of an enzymatic reaction is the rate constant times the concentration of the enzyme times the concentration of the substrate. So even if the rate is low, if you have a lot of enzyme or a lot of substrate, you can still push, have a lot of flux.
So that could offset the...
The fact that the enzymes are inefficient. Yeah.
Okay. Because the reactants, there are more concentrations.
Yeah.
Understanding of metabolomic studies is that you get a lot of molecules and you don't know what they are. And I'm wondering now, how much do you think these promiscuous reactions may be contributing to these unknown metabolites in the study?
That is such a beautiful question. And I think about that a lot, actually. I suspect that a lot of these sort of unknown metabolites are the result of these leaks in metabolism that have been sort of ignored. Okay, everybody exhausted. Sorry that went so long, and I only told you half the story, too.
That was like a master class, though.